Accession number 28735, Reel 11.
Rickman, Reel 11. You were just about to tell me of a second experience of something.
Yes, indeed. An interesting one from a different point of view, because this was a rover patrol. It was one which started up in Holland and came back along down the coast. I think it was in Muiden, I-U-D-E-N, it's just below the Hook of Holland somewhere up there. Anyway, we started patrol there, and after a few minutes, my observer, John, calls me up and says, big blip coming up, Ricky. I said, how far? He said, about 3 miles. And I said, well, it's pitch black, I can't see a thing at the moment, but maybe soon. What course? He gave me the course, I headed for it. I'm again at 3,000 feet and steering sort of southwest. And eventually he calls me again and he says, it's only a mile away now, can't you see anything? And I said, no, not absolutely black. And then he says, it's half a mile, we're practically on top of it, you must be able to see it now. I said, I'm sorry, Johnny, not a thing, no blue. And suddenly all hell broke loose. Cannon fire, yellow, red, orange, three streaks of cannon shells were going up in front of me. The crew was saying, there's cannon shells going up on the side and behind us. Yeah. We were surrounded by about 8 gunfire, all firing up at us. And the shells, you could see them, yellow streaks apart and so on, orange streaks apart. I figured they were 40 feet between them only. I've got a 54-foot wingspan. I thought about it and wrote it down, and I wrote this article about that event, that it was like being a drunken parrot in an incandescent cage. And I thought, what the hell do I do? I can't get through. I'm going to get these shells are going to hit me. And I suddenly remembered what my squadron leader had done in that forced landing, when he turned the Sigermoth on its side. And I went through between two of the lines of shells with the wings up and down. And got through and went down to ground sea level, 50 feet above sea level. I haven't told you that we've got a radio altimeter on the Avenger, so from the bottom of the bomb bay to whatever's there at the ground, you can tell. So 50 feet above the sea at night is no problem, yeah. And I circled, and I got away as quickly as I could, actually. Because, of course, what would have happened is we'd flown over a flagship or an island on which there were a whole row of guns, but that's why, because it wasn't moving, there was no tail, you see. But we didn't get hit, and we were just scared that time, yeah. And it was soon after that that we returned all our aircraft to Leon Solent, sent on embarkation leave, because they didn't need the fleet arm against the bridgehead anymore. They needed us out east against the Japs.
Had your aircraft worn any form of distinctive markings during that period?
Do you mean the black and white stripes? Yes, we had the all Allied aircraft from the D-Day landings onwards in that theatre of war had black, broad black and white stripes, 5 on the root of each wing, as it were, on either side of the fuselage, and on the tail of the fuselage, behind the air gunner. Fortunately, I didn't have to paint those myself. I might have had to do, because when I joined the squadron after Knocker White had left it, all the flying officers, the air crew for officers in the squadron, were given a separate job apart from their flying. So one was in charge of torpedoes, another one was in charge of navigation maps or whatever. And when I joined, the CO said, "What are you doing, Civvy Street?" And I said, "I was an art student." He said, "Right, you're a squadron artist. Your first job is design a badge for the, for the squadron," which I did. And I thought being a squadron artist is easy. I did a nice big chart that was in our squadron office with all the names of crews and every attack they made and what the result was, the 44 yards astern, direct hit, believe, possible, or whatever, you know. And that's an interesting record, because not only did we, I sank those two ships, I think they sank overnight. Apart from that, no one else did in the squadron. But two of our aircraft shot down flying bombs, because flying bombs were going across, and they happened to see one at the daytime. They managed to get into a position vis-à-vis it, because they flew twice the speed we did. They flew at 400 miles an hour. But if you could get ahead of one and let it pass you, you could shoot it down. So two flying bombs were shot down by members of our squadron.
You designed a badge. What was the design of the badge for the squadron?
The badge, the squadron crest, as it was called. I called it a crest, but the Navy called it a badge. It was a lion and a sword and the sea, wavy blue and white lines underneath each other. I was told to that those were the subjects. Go away and design a badge of that sort. And just being an artist, I chose a lion coming at you like this. You know, good dynamic picture. Unfortunately, this had to be sent to the School of Heraldry, you see, to be approved. And of course, there are certain methods of portraying a lion which are acceptable in heraldry, and sometimes one which is different, it can be called proper. So they altered my design slightly and made it sort of semi-proper, not rampant and not passant and so on, you see. And there was a badge, the motto underneath, "Audentis fortuna juvat," fortune follows the brave. So I still have a copy of it.
what was the next move then? Obviously, after you got to that stage, did you say you had to hand your aircraft in at that point?
Yes. Went on leave. Embarkation leave. Report to HMS Activity. That's a small carrier. At Portsmouth, whenever it was, sometime in the autumn of 44, September-ish. And no aircraft. We boarded Activity without any aircraft. There were some other troops on board, I couldn't tell you who or what. But we went out through the Med, through the Suez Canal. We stopped at Alexandria, actually, just for half a day, in time for me to buy a Sherlock Holmes pipe very cheaply, in a local shop, where the shopkeeper wanted me to go through his curtains into his back room and haggle for half an hour about the price of it, and I wasn't going to get robbed or have my throat cut by his assistant. So I gave him the price he asked and walked out. And it was not surprising when one of my fellow pilots walked off the gangways to the ship in the same place, Alexandra Harbour. A gang of kids come up and said, I be your guide, Captain, I be your guide, I show you around all this. And 14 of them, they jostle you and so on. And he said no and so on, walked away, and then he clapped his hand and said, "God, they've stolen my wallet." You 4-year-olds, 8-year-olds, you know. And I thought, this is not going to happen to me. I'm not going to have my wallet pinched in the back room of some scruffy Egyptian shop. So we went through. We stopped at Aden briefly after going through the Suez Canal. That was interesting, because there wasn't much space either side of the carrier, I tell you. So it went very slowly. And out at the other end, across the Indian Ocean, to Cochin in southern Kerala, India, where there were new Avengers waiting for us, which had been sent from the States the other way, from them straight to India. And they were in big wooden packing cases, just like Airfix kits, only the proper thing. So the crates had to be opened. The riggers and the fitters both did that together. The riggers then assembled all the parts that needed nutting and bolting together to make the airframe and rigged it. The fitters assembled the engines and fitted the engines on and then tested them. And when they got everything all together, they told the pilots to go and test fire them and make sure that everything was tight, nothing was loose. So we test flew them without the observer, you see, being there, just in case. And had new set of Avengers. From there, which was southern India, we flew down to Colombo in Sri Lanka, then Ceylon, because Churchill had been asked by President Roosevelt for help in the Pacific, and Churchill couldn't give it. All his troops, particularly Navy, were concerned with the D-Day business and, of course, eventually the planning for the Italian invasion from North Africa. And consequently, only now, late 44, could he spare to put a fleet together and send it out east. So this fleet was met and assembled in Trincomalee Harbour, which is up in the sort of northeast of Sri Lanka, whereas Colombo was down in the south. So four carriers were assembled at that harbour, plus the rest of the battle cruisers and the destroyers and, of course, a fleet train. I guess there must have been between 100 and 200 ships involved in that fleet. And we, 854, were sent to a place called Katu Karanda, which is a jungle airstrip, just a strip carved out of sheer jungle, palm trees and things, and what's called Summerfield tracking put down. Summerfield tracking is like just like pieces of giant Meccano, but clipped together, and there are holes in it, and so it makes a metal surface, but it's got lots of holes in it so it can be drained through, therefore it's all weather use. Jolly effective, jolly good, brilliant stuff. And I've got a number of pictures of that, photographs of the squadron. I had the whole squadron photographed on it, and in one case it was all the flying crews were sitting down in front of it, and a lot of the working crews were standing on the wings. About 15 men standing on each of the Avengers' wings, taking this photograph against the background of palm trees. Yeah. Quite an interesting Eastern presence, you might say. We worked up for about 2 months, and it consisted eventually, of course, of joining Illustrious, which was where we were going to be the bomber squadron of Illustrious. All the four carriers had one bomber squadron on board plus two fighter squadrons, sometimes Corsairs, sometimes Hellcats, the old Firefly, and so on. And because, of course, the British Navy had never operated a fleet with four carriers all working together, and other destroyers protecting, of course, it took some doing, some organising. So we had to go on various strikes, as they were called, attacks, on the Japanese, mainly in Sumatra. Not Burma. On Sumatra, because A, we needed the practice in organising what you do, how many planes do you, what is the disposition of the fleet, which should go where, why do you not put all your destroyers in an outer circle, because you need one behind each carrier in case the pilot ditches and so on, the destroyer can pick him up and so on. Matters like this had to be thought about, discussed, worked out, practiced. And once we had done that, worked up, then we were ready to join Illustrious.
Was it different operating in tropical conditions? Or did the aircraft operate differently? Were there other aspects of that?
Yes, it was slightly different, yeah. Does make a lot of difference when you're up in the air, temperature-wise, because, of course, you've always got a cockpit hood and you're flying, so there's always draft air coming in, even albeit warm air. But we went out there from winter in England, you see, where we were wearing battle dresses, very similar to this, zip fasteners and winter clothing. And we soon found it was not a good idea to fly in battle dress. It was too hot. And so our CEO said, right, local tailor, got the chap to come up from the local village, measured up all the aircrew. He wanted boiler suits making, long overall boiler suits that had press fasteners up the front, all one piece. Thin, porridgey coloured, uncoloured material, undressed as it were. But because it came down to your wrists and so on, in case of fire, you were virtually covered. That's the reason for it. It was very unfortunate from my point of view, because one day we were in a briefing room. We were going to do some bombing practice, and we got our new overalls on. We had to, in pens, write our rank, our sub-lieutenant's rank on. Even this squadron commander, who was a lieutenant commander, he called himself a sub-lieutenant in case he was shot down by the Japs. But we went into the briefing room, and we were sitting around in the horseshoe, and the officer briefing us about this bombing exercise. I was sitting there with a pad on here, and Johnny, my observer, normally would have sat next to me, but there wasn't space, and he was sitting across the other side somewhere. And after an initial briefing, the officer said, "Oh, I'm going to get Wren officer so-and-so to tell you about the bombing, because it's Wren's who are doing the spotting of the bombs and where they go, and she can tell you about that now." So she came in and started to talk, and then suddenly broke off and hesitated and stuttered and stammered, and then resumed and then stuttered again, and eventually sort of finished off and went out. And the meeting broke up, and Johnny came over, and I said, "That main officer wasn't very articulate, was she? Seemed to be making a mess of things." And he said, "Yeah, it was your fault, you bloody fool." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, your cock was hanging out." Yeah. It was the tailor's fault. He put the press fasteners a long way apart, especially down there.
So, with the boiler suits, you wouldn't wear anything underneath them, would you?
Yeah, a pair of pants. Yeah, that's all.
I was thinking, when you actually flew as well in the aircraft, was there anything that you would take? I'm thinking really things like survival aids that you might not have used in Northwest Europe, but would you take other things on operations while you were working up in the Indian Ocean?
No difference really. You all had Mae West on, of course, on top, which contained an escape pack in the back, plastic escape pack, which had a razor in it and bit of chocolate, a condom, which was not for you normal use. It was protecting the penis if you were in leech infested rivers and things. So and marvelous maps. incredible maps of the area where you were, so you could, if you were shot down and could make your way to freedom, as it were, you'd have a map of the area. But they were pure silk. Because they were pure silk, they were squashed right down to a very, very tiny volume. And you took this little thing out, and suddenly it opened out, and it was a 3-foot by 2-foot map, you know. Brilliant.
Would you carry water?
No, not. I used to carry lime juice in a water bottle down beside my cockpit seat. But that was only just because it was nice to drink lime juice when you were on a long flight and patrol, but you weren't forced to do it, no. And there was no need to do it necessarily. No.
And during this period while you were working up, you mentioned bombing practice. Were you doing an awful lot of bombing practice prior to doing the operations? Was that what your aim was seen to be then? I mean, because I know you trained with torpedo dropping. Had that completely disappeared by then?
Or? The torpedoing was out, yes. There was no question of torpedoes. Reason being that we were attacking the Japanese, really. And most of the Japanese fleet was round in the Pacific. And we weren't there yet. We were in the Indian Ocean. Consequently, it was mainly Japanese targets on shore, ports, installations, oil refineries, what have you, things like that. And we had to do, of course, a lot of addles, because we hadn't been doing any deck addles much at Orkinge. Actually, we had 2 or 3 months there. Hadn't done a single deck landing there. You do tend to get out of practice if you don't do it, you know. Consequently, lots of addles, and then eventually, of course, flew on to Illustrious. Not necessarily permanently, while for a week and so on, and then back to Ceylon, offloaded for a time for some reason. I don't know why, but that's not my responsibility. Crews just did as they were told. Yeah.
Could I ask, actually, when you landed on a carrier like Illustrious,
yes,
what's the kind of arrestor wire and barrier setup that exists, and how do you position your aircraft so the hook will catch it again?
The arrestor wires was a system which, oddly enough, was introduced by an uncle of a friend of mine way back in the 20s. And they are wires, they're about 3/4 of an inch diameter, wire hauser, and they stretch right across the width, more or less across the width of the carrier at the stern end, the round down, as we call it. The round down is where it slopes down. It's when it's on the, when it gets on the level just above the round down, then there's the first wire. And there were 6 wires. They would be something like 6 feet apart now. So you have a sort of 30 to 40 foot area lengthwise that when you're coming in, your hook has got to try and catch one of those wires. Now. When it caught the wires went down through the deck down to holes with hydraulic weights and things on at the bottom. So the more they were pulled, the stronger the pressure got, so the quicker the aircraft was stopped. But unfortunately, even with 6 wires and a good strong hook that could take the weight of an aeroplane pulling against it when it caught a wire, even so, sometimes when you came in, your hook was dangling down almost vertically, not quite, it would hit the deck and bounce between the wires. Now, if that happened, of course, you would be careering up the deck at 70 miles an hour, ahead of which you might be 10 or 20 parked aircraft. And if that happened and you went into them, you would write off 4 or 5 aircraft undoubtedly, straight away in a second or two. So I had to put up a thing called the barrier. And this was just beside the island, near enough, halfway up the deck. And up it came, a great big, just like a tennis net, only big, on iron levers, steel levers that raised up vertically, holding these about 6 or 7 smaller wire hoses than the arrestor gear, but pretty tough stuff. And that was called the crash barrier. And if you missed the wires, then you would go into the crash barrier, which would, in most cases, just stop the aircraft, bend the propeller. If the aircraft happened to go up, you might damage the undercarriage. Not usually that difficult. So you damage the aircraft a fair bit and might have to replace certain parts, mainly at the front, of course. But unfortunately, with things being what they were, some planes smaller than others, the fighters compared with the bombers, strange things do happen. And I saw one landing take place of a Corsair pilot who came. I think he had an extra bomb, petrol tank attached to his aircraft for some reason, and he missed the wires and went into the barrier. The petrol tank came off, and unfortunately, because the spark from the engine caught it, the whole thing sort of suddenly blazed up. He climbed out onto the wing beside him, because of the speed of the ship, the rest of the flames had been blown backwards. And had he just jumped forward onto the deck, which was dry, and at that point, he would have been alive today. But unfortunately, because that was higher than the trailing edge, which was lower, nearer the ground, he opted to go for that. But he slipped on some oil as he hit the deck and fell in the flames. The aircraft was a total write-off and just had to be dropped over the side. He was in sick bay with severe burns. And the surgeon had to amputate first his left foot, and then his left knee, and then his left thigh. There's gangrene set in, and the doctor was trying to beat it, but couldn't, and it was just going up the body so quickly, killed him. So deck landings are very varied characteristics.
And what was HMS Illustrious like as a carrier? Because I know you've landed on Argus prior to that, but what was she like as a carrier?
It's difficult to compare because I didn't go on any other carrier. I was only on the one. I mean, I was on the activity, of course, going out, and I'd been on Pretoria Castle for a couple of hours, but living and working on a ship is what counts. Illustrious was one of the four, all the same class, all the same design. They were designed for 1,000 men, including squadrons on board. But wartime being what it was, squadrons were bigger than they used to be, and consequently there were 1,500 men on board, most of them. Therefore, although Illustrious had a water distillation system where it could take in salt water, and by distilling it, it could produce fresh water, desalination plant, you see. So you could shower. But the trouble was that because of the hot weather, everybody wanted to shower at the same sort of time, the end of the work day. And the water, although it was fresh, never had time to cool down. So in the showers, you go in and there'd be 20 naked men in there saying, "Oh, let's have a sing-song, fellas," and we'd be singing about, I don't know, Ireland or Scotland or somewhere, Bonnie Scotland and so on, and then you nip under the shower and it was scalding hot, you see. and then back singing a song. Showers were the best place for singing because they being more metal, the resonance of the sound, especially four-part harmony, which we got in some places, and sometimes the old squeak and squeal from the chaps who were getting the scalding hot water. So that was the only drawback that I can remember. Apart from that, she had a reputation of being a happy ship, and this happened to ships in wartime and in the Navy generally throughout history. Some ships are happy ships and others are not. Whether this is due to the captain and his handling, or whether it's just the assembly of team members that form the crew, not the squadrons who come and go, but the main crew. Oh dear. Off, out, out, up. Watch out, watch out. No, you've got.